This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Another battle over abortion regulations played out in Washington this week. This time the conflict was within the Republican Party over a bill in the House that would have banned abortions beyond 20 weeks of pregnancy. Republican Renee Elmers of the 2nd District in North Carolina led the opposition, but then after attacks by anti-abortion groups, Elmers changed her mind and announced her support. In any event, the House leadership pulled that bill. Meanwhile, a separate bill that cuts federal funding for abortions passed in the House with Elmer's support. And that is just one of the stories that made headlines in North Carolina this week. So we'll talk about student achievement as well, teacher tenure, and film incentives, all part of our news roundup today on the State of Things. We'll start in Washington with Tarini Partee. She is a reporter for Politico, and she's been following the progress of the House abortion bills. Tarini, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to the original plans earlier this week about the abortion bill that was ultimately pulled by the Republican leadership.
Well, yesterday was the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which we know legalized abortion. And every year there are thousands of people who come to D.C. to protest. And the House Republican leadership wanted to use that day to sort of send a unifying message. And one of the bills that in the past has received huge support from House Republicans was banning abortions after 20 weeks. Now, the bill contained some language that turned out to be more controversial. It allowed an exemption for rape victims, but only if they reported their attack to the police. So we saw Renee Elmer sort of emerge as the face of this opposition for a while. A lot of women, a lot of moderate Republicans joined her, and in the end, they had to drop the bill.
But in the meantime, Renee Elmer's changed her position, right?
She did. She said that her district is very pro-life, and if that was their wish, she would, go in favor of it. But, there was a lot of tension, a lot of protesters outside her office yesterday. Some even said that they were going to try to find a Republican to run against her in a primary in 2016. And as we know, Renee Elmers is very conservative. She has a very conservative record. So it would be hard to find someone to her right. But, they sort of threatened her with a primary challenge even.
But as you say, she, and again, it's hard to find anybody to her right. There were other members of the House, other Republicans, some more moderate, who led the opposition to the particular bill that ultimately got pulled. I mean, tell us about that. That seems like a kind of gross miscalculation on the part of the House leadership.
That's definitely something that the leadership is now looking at. In the past, they've faced opposition from conservative, the more Tea Party crowd, but now they have such a huge majority in the House that they're facing opposition from even the moderates, who are now sort of getting their strength back just because there's such a huge number of Republicans in the House, all from different backgrounds, ideologies. So the leadership is now going to have to cater to several different types of Republicans, not just the more Tea Party crowd that, has caused trouble in the last 2 years.
All right. So that bill banning certain abortions is taken off the table, but a different bill about abortions, and this about abortion funding, did pass yesterday. Tell us about that.
The bill that ended up passing really was a watered-down version that has passed before, really carries no value. It bans federal funding to be used for abortions, which is something that already doesn't happen. So it's not really something that carries any weight. It was a disappointment for House leadership, who really, as I said, wanted to send that unifying message on the 20-week ban, which is something a lot of states have passed. But in the end, they couldn't make it happen. They said they're going to try again, so we'll have to see what happens in the coming weeks.
All right, and set the scene for us. Yesterday, you talked about you made reference to the fact that it was the 42nd anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Protesters in Washington every year, to set the scene for us. What did it look like yesterday?
Well, there were thousands of protesters out here in Washington. Very hard to get around the city for us, but a lot of them were camped outside of Renee Elmers' office, protesting all day. As I said, she became the face of this opposition. You couldn't really get around the city without seeing these anti-abortion activists everywhere.
All right, Tarini, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Tarini Parti is a reporter for Politico. She joined us today on our news roundup. Well, that's the news from Washington. Plenty going on here in the Tar Heel State. In North Carolina, a judge heard arguments this week about new proficiency standards for public schools. At issue is whether the new policy properly prepares our students for the next grade level or if it in fact lowers standards and leaves them behind their peers. Judge Howard Manning regularly considers North Carolina's education policy. He's looking to make sure it follows the state constitution, and that calls for students to receive a sound basic education. Emory D'Alessio has been covering the story for the Associated Press, and he joins us now. Welcome, Emory. Good to have you here.
Hi, thanks.
Tell us a little bit about this. Give us some of the background on the standards themselves. They were changed. The State Board of Education came up with a new set of standards. So tell us about those standards.
Right. So a few years back, the State Board of Education started to make curricula more difficult for the 21st century. And in recognition of that, they decided, well, we're kind of passing third graders onto the fourth grade if they get close to a certain margin. And so let's just create a five-tier system that counts them. There used to be a four-tier system, and what the state Supreme Court decided that if you are proficient, that's the third level, and that's good. That's what we want our kids to be, proficient. And so level three counted, and now they have a five-level system. Now what does that mean for level three? So that's what the judge wanted to hear more details about.
We should take us back now to find out why it is a judge is looking at state proficiency standards in the first place.
Right. Well, in 1994, a handful of poor school districts filed a lawsuit that said our kids can't get the same break that the other kids can, so we should do something about funding. And that's called the Leandro case after one of the families that were party to that lawsuit. The Supreme Court has twice weighed in on that case, and they set the definition that you described, that every child in North Carolina has the right to a chance at a good basic education. And they put Judge Manning in charge of overseeing, is it happening? And that's what he periodically calls hearings about, to see, is it happening?
And that we are doing this news roundup today on the state of things. Emory D'Alessio is with me right now. We're talking about a change in state education standards overseen, in this case, by Judge Howard Manning. I mean, he's looked at other cases, pre-K education as well, access. If you reduced access to pre-K education, he weighed in on that last year, right?
Not last year. He had a hearing on that in 2011. And in 2013, the Supreme Court decided, well, the General Assembly fixed the problem that they created, so the case is moot and we're not going any further.
I bring that up just to show that this has been a series of cases and, as you say, a series of hearings along the way to make sure that this basic standard is being met. So let's take a look now at this change of standards. Proficient has met the standards for proficiency, tier three, on to fourth grade. That's the way it had been. Now you come up with this multi-tier system of five-tier system. And the rub is a kind of fourth step that says, well, yes, you're proficient, but you might need some help once you get to fourth grade.
That's right. So in calling for the hearing that he scheduled this week, Judge Manning wrote an order or wrote in November that this looked like academic doublespeak, and so he wanted to have this hearing and see what it was they were talking about.
And he got even more colorful than that when he took a look at kind of the language and the justification. In most states, it's if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's a duck. Of course, this is North Carolina, so he substituted a pig.
So if it snorts like a pig, it must be a pig.
So where does it stand now? I mean, he's a judge. His job is to make sure that we are meeting this constitutional test. He hasn't ruled on it yet, but he's given us a pretty clear indication he's not happy with these changes, right?
Well, he heard some things in the hearing that seemed to be mollifying his skepticism. And so it's still it's up to him. His job is to see, are kids learning? Are they graduating? Are they getting ready for a life after high school? And whether he'll decide that the elementary school kids are on track with that, that's up to him.
And what would happen should he rule that these standards, frankly, don't meet the test, that the kids aren't getting a fair and basic education? Does it throw them out, or is there another step in the process?
He may decide that, you're not meeting the standards of proficiency. I'm not satisfied. Kids on the old four-level standard, they're not making it. And there was one estimate that over half of the third graders would not be making this. It's more difficult. The standards are more advanced. They would not be making it, at least in the first year. Whether kids have caught up to some extent, I don't know.
Any idea when we'll get a ruling?
His track record has shown weeks or months.
All right. Well, we will stay tuned, and we will be back with you then. Emory D'Alessio, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Emory D'Alessio, a reporter with the Associated Press. We're doing a news roundup today. We'll take a look at more news headlines in detail when the State of Things continues from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio with a news roundup today on the program. Just a minute ago, we were talking with Emory D'Alessio of the Associated Press about Judge Howard Manning and considering student proficiency. Education was also in the news. In another arena, the General Assembly passed a law in 2013 that called for experienced teachers to give up certain job protections in exchange for annual salary increases. Well, the Superior Court said that was unconstitutional. Well, both the state and teachers appealed. The state wants the appeals court to overturn the ruling. Teachers want the judges to go further and protect those who have not received tenure. Joining us now is Laura Leslie, Capital Bureau Chief for WRAL. Welcome back, Laura.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, tell us more. It's a pleasure to have you. Tell us more about the law itself and what it says, and then we'll get to some of the arguments for and against.
Right. Now, in the past, the way this worked is if a teacher was working in a district for 4 years of good performance, in their fifth year, they could appeal for what's called career status, or what people call tenure, although it's not exactly what you think of as tenure. What career status said is that there were a set number of things for which a teacher could be fired. And if they were fired, then they were entitled to have a hearing about the firing or about any discipline. But they couldn't just sort of be fired arbitrarily. What the and what people who back this say is that it gives teachers a lot of freedom if they want to do things, for example, that maybe school administrators don't like. It also protects them from the politics of school boards, the politics of Raleigh. If they have a position that's not the position of their school leaders or their local representative, they don't have to worry about any kind of recrimination. Under the new law, that tenure would go away, and teachers would all be under 1, 2, or 4-year contracts subject to renewal, and they could be non-renewed for any reason or no reason, simply not renewed. Now, as you can imagine, this was not popular with the teachers who had, gone through this process and who had obtained these job protections. And so they sued, basically telling the state that that was a property right, and which it is under state law. And that the state can't simply take that away from them without compensation.
And, of course, there was a pay raise that went along with that, right?
Yeah, it was $500 a year for 4 years.
Right. And so that was the exchange, right?
For the top 25% of teachers.
Right.
But for the rest of them, they got nothing. They just lost their protection. And about more than half of the state's 95,000 teachers have this protection. It does not mean, and this is a common misconception, it doesn't mean that a bad teacher can't be fired.
Right.
And bad teachers do get fired. It just means that before you can fire a teacher, you have to actually come up with reasons that are in the statute.
Right. And it sets the process for adjudicating those reasons.
Right.
And that's a due process kind of a question. Bad teachers can go, just prove it through this process. That's
right.
Gone. Teachers say, wait a minute, that's a due process. That is a worker right. You took that away from us. The state, however, disagrees. Its argument is that this is not about due process. It's about education policy.
Yeah. And they say that basically their argument is that it is too difficult for school districts to get rid of bad teachers, and that this would allow school districts to sort of push some folks out to make room for perhaps better teachers coming in. They also argue that this isn't actually taking anything away from the teachers because nobody's actually lost a job over it yet. that, you know, this is simply modifying the terms of their agreement with the state. But there is precedent. There's a state Supreme Court decision from the 1930s in which they found, and this has never been counteracted or, you know, overturned, in which the state Supreme Court found that, yes, a contractual right is a property right, that you have an interest in protecting the terms of your contract as you sign them when you agree to take the job. And that's really the crux of the argument. You know, both sides say this isn't really about teacher tenure. This is about whether or not the state can simply take away contractual rights.
All right. And so the Superior Court has already ruled on that and said, yep, unconstitutional, can't do it. It's now at the appeals court. Interestingly enough, the state has filed an appeal and said, you know, we don't think, taken it to the appeals court. We think it's simply policy. It's not a property right. But teachers also have filed an appeal. Tell us about that.
Right. And that's because when Judge Robert Hobgood ruled on this, that's the Superior Court you were talking about. He ruled on it last year. And so his argument is that teachers who had already achieved career status by 2013 when lawmakers moved to throw it out, those teachers were injured, in fact, by having their rights taken away. However, there were a lot of teachers in the pipeline on the way to career status. And he said, well, they hadn't reached it yet, so they didn't lose anything. And the teachers group is asking the Court of Appeals to extend the protections to those teachers that hadn't yet earned the career status, because their argument is that those teachers took the job with the understanding that this was something that they could earn. And so it was still part of the reason that they took the job, part of the terms of employment, even if they hadn't yet gotten there.
All right. And so you were at the hearings. What were the judges saying? Any indication of how they're feeling about this case?
They were pretty skeptical. You know, basically, it was the presiding judges, Martha Geer, and then Linda Stevens and Judge Dillon as well. You know, obviously, they had questions for both sides, but the questions for the state's Deputy Attorney General, Melissa Tripp, were a lot sharper. And the judges, I mean, clearly are looking at this as a contract issue, not as an educational issue. So I'd be surprised if they went with the state all the way. But they did have some other questions about whether or not you know, changes can be made to contracts and changes can be made to statutes. And so, you know, whether this would fall under something that could conceivably be sort of explained or justified by the state's interest in trying to improve educational outcomes. But as Judge Linda Stevens put it, okay, if the idea is to improve educational outcomes, then doing something that basically tells good teachers that they should look elsewhere to find a job is not going to improve your educational outcome, because all the states around us actually have some type of career status protection for due process. We would be the outlier in the Southeast.
All right. Any idea when we might get a ruling?
Well, they average 90 days. But that can be anywhere from a week to half a year. So, you know, I suspect probably sometime later this spring, maybe.
All right. Well, stay with us, Laura. We're doing the news roundup today on the state of things, but we're going to change gears a little bit and talk about a new policy for film incentives in North Carolina this year. Legislature drastically cut funds available to production companies that want to film in the state. And that prompted yet another TV show to leave Wilmington this week. The city has been home to big productions for decades. That is changing. Joining our conversation is Hunter Ingram. He's a reporter for the Star News of Wilmington and regularly writes about the film industry in North Carolina. Hunter, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us about the changes to the film incentives policy.
So the film incentive policy change, it's actually moving away from an incentive, and it will be moving towards a grant program. And before, the incentive had no cap to it. You could earn up to $20 million, but there was no cap to funding. Now, productions can only earn up to $5 million, and there's only $10 million worth of funding. So it's a dramatic drop in how much money is available to productions and how much that an actual program will lure productions in.
All right, and that has already had an impact on the industry down there. Tell us about how things have changed and give us the landscape. Production companies are leaving already, right?
They are. Well, it's more of productions that are leaving. So this week we saw the end of Sleepy Hollow, which is a Fox TV series, which has become very popular. It's filmed its first two seasons here in Wilmington. It started back last spring of 2013. And as of Wednesday, they have wrapped production and informed both the crew around here and the industry that they will be moving production to Atlanta in Georgia, where they have a very promising film incentive. if there is a third season of the show ordered, which has not been done yet, but many people say that there is a possibility for it.
How about other productions? Yeah, go ahead.
And other productions, there's one production that has been filming here and is the only one that's filming right now. It's called Bolden, and it is a biopic of a jazz player. But it's been around for a few years, so it's not really new. So there aren't really any new productions coming in. Under the Dome, which is a CBS summer series, it's the only production that will be returning that we know of this year. It also shot its first two seasons, but it's not coming until spring. And as of right now, that is the only thing that's coming, and everything else has left.
Well, as we say, the film industry and TV industry had been booming in Wilmington for a while. Laura Leslie, from your perch in Raleigh, have you heard from the state film office about pending productions in North Carolina?
Yeah, and it's what I was saying. Hunter was saying, rather, there has not, you know, basically there's five films from North Carolina that are going to hit the theaters this year. One of them's already there, but there is nothing new coming in. And you know, the state film office chief Guy Gaster, I spoke with him earlier this week, and he said that, you know, there are some productions that may be interested, possibly if they can get a grant. But as we were just saying, with a $10 million cap and Under the Dome expected to take up about $5 million, that's only leaving about $5 million, which, you know, for a feature film, if it's a small indie film, you know, that might be an enticement for it. But for the big blockbusters that bring in a lot of jobs and that employ a lot of people, that's not going to stand up to what offers are in Georgia and in other states where these productions, even South Carolina, where the productions are moving. And so, you know, one big concern is, you know, right now the state has some other things that sort of it can sell. And one of that is that it's got a crew base in Wilmington and that area. And also in Charlotte, there are lots of areas around the state. But as those productions dry up, the question is, do those crews move to where the work is? And in that case, is North Carolina going to end up without that advantage as well?
Well, then, Hunter, we talked about $10 million in grant money available, $5 million likely to go to Dome. The other $5 million might also be spoken for already. Is that right?
Well, some of it, possibly. Sleepy Hollow, their production actually trailed into the first 3 weeks of January. And Sleepy Hollow is one of those productions that will be submitting its first two seasons for the incentive money. So it's likely that they will submit those 3 weeks of filming to this pot of money from the grant program, which means that some of it could go to Sleepy Hollow, the $5 million would go to Under the Dome, and then there's less than $5 million left for other productions.
Well, as we know, the productions can come and go, and then there are the production companies that have some brick and mortar in Wilmington. How have they come together to support the film industry? Are they organizing, Hunter?
As of right now, the organization is really coming from locals. There's a lot of local small businesses. There's a lot of local crew members who are still trying to fight for this. Just recently, there was the organization of a small group called Small Businesses for Film that, as of today, I confirmed has around 210 members of small businesses who are trying to get the word out and to try and keep the discussion going about keeping funding for this industry in North Carolina.
Forgive me for interrupting, but any indication of, or do we know, what percentage of North Carolina's total economic output the film industry had represented up until now?
We don't, but we do know how much of the economic output specific from the film industry. Last year, they spent around $240 million in local spending. Which is a big number, and it's something that they've really put in the forefront of their arguments that there is a lot of spending happening.
Yeah, Laura?
I would just add to that. Actually, statewide, it's more like $316 million when you go and you include the other counties where they've filmed. So, I mean, compared to the state budget, it's not much, but it's an industry that does bring in money.
And the way the incentives were structured, as I understand it, and you could both correct me, that it was about incentives for spending money on things that you would buy locally. In other words, that incentive money that we lost was actually re-spent. It couldn't just go to shareholders. It couldn't just end up in the pockets of the film production company that then they dispersed to shareholders elsewhere. It had to be spent in the economy in order to qualify for the incentive. Am I right about that?
Yes. The qualifying expenses for the incentive had to be done on things spent in North Carolina.
Yeah.
So it was local spending that was done. Anything else like post-production services that were done possibly in L.A. or elsewhere, those did not qualify. So, yes, that money was for local spending statewide.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned. Hunter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hunter Ingram, a reporter with the Star News in Wilmington. He joined us from WHQR in Wilmington. This is our news roundup today on the state of things, and there is more news around the state. The state legislature, as we said, drastically cut funding. And, of course, as the new session begins, there's been a kind of a shift in power, a shift to the east. And John Elliston joins us now to talk about some of the members of the state legislature who have ascended to either before this session or this year, who are actually from Western North Carolina as the GOP takes power. And, you know, historically, as we say, power has always been Democrats in Eastern North Carolina. Now we're seeing Republicans from the West. John Elliston, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us about that, because, you know, big issues this year, Medicaid, education, and, of course, a new budget. And for that, we would look to Western North Carolina for some of the leadership. Tell us who's taking those leadership positions.
Sure. Historically, as you noted, we felt a little isolated in the West from time to time when it comes to Raleigh. Of course, for years when the Democrats were in the majority, we had Senator Martin Nesbitt, who was in positions of power. In the last few years, that obviously wasn't the case, and sadly, he, in fact, passed away last year. But under the Republican leadership, we've got a number of leaders from the West. Predominant among them is Senator Tom Apodaca from Henderson County. He's been named to a whopping total of 12 committees for the upcoming session, and he chairs or co-chairs about a half a dozen of those.
All right. And then also, you know, we move on to Ralph Hise as well, Senator from McDowell. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's going to be a major player in whatever moves the General Assembly might make on some health care related situations, in that he is the co-chair of both the Committee on Appropriations on Health and Human Services and the Health Care Committee. And so that's certainly a topic where he'll be weighing in and, in fact, has already advanced some potential legislation.
We're doing the news roundup today on the State of Things. John Elliston is with us from Carolina Public Press, and Laura Leslie from WRAL also with us. So tell us about politically Tom Apodaca. Give us a little bit of a profile.
Well, he's taken to leadership with a lot of verve and vigor. He's been a very active and, frankly, quite powerful legislator for the past few years. In his day job, he's a bail bondsman, but he has really taken to legislative work and to the ways and means of the Senate and the rules and operations. He chairs both of those committees. So in the event you want to get anything done in the state Senate, Apodaca is a good person to know, and it's good to be in his good graces.
Laura Leslie, Senator Ralph Hise, McDowell County, as we say, again, co-chair of Appropriations on Health and Human Services. And, of course, legislation considering Medicaid reform is coming up. What does Senator Hise have to say about that?
Well, Senator Hise is an interesting case because, he's a young guy, as legislators go. Anyway, a very quick rise into the leadership, and very close, obviously, to the folks who are in the seats of power in the Senate. He is very, he is sort of carrying the torch for the Senate in the idea of removing Medicaid from DHHS and wanting to see a large amount of reform very quickly, and expressing, Senator Hise has many times expressed, real frustration that there's no way to cap the amount of money, to limit the amount of money that goes into this entitlement program. So he is, a major force, as you say, in the crafting of health policy and in health spending. But on the House side, they don't necessarily agree with Senator Hise's ideas, and the governor doesn't agree with them either. And so, it sort of looks like it's going to be sort of the House and the governor in this session against the Senate in terms of how they want to reform Medicaid. But, there's something else that's interesting about the political makeup this year, and that is that in both the Senate and the House, the Democrats have chosen a second in command that is also from the West. Buncombe Democrat Susan Fisher is the deputy minority leader in the House, for want of a better term. Terry Van Dyne, who replaced Martin Nesbitt, is in the Senate. And so we see a shift in both parties, with the West having more of a say than it has perhaps in years past. And we saw some of the most interesting changes in the makeup in the House happen out West. That was when Representative Tim Moffitt and Representative Nathan Ramsey, Buncombe County and then Henderson, lost their seats, both of which were members, Moffitt especially, Ramsey perhaps a little bit less so, but both were sort of members of the House leadership, and both of them went down in November's election, which was, I think, very surprising to a lot of people, that those were not necessarily two of the seats they would have thought were going to go, but they did. So clearly, a lot of eyes turned westward, a lot of attention being paid to the dynamics out west around Buncombe County and Asheville and further up in the mountains.
Well, John, I've only got about 20 seconds left, but if you had to characterize how this is being perceived out west, is this a kind of sense of finally we're getting our day in the legislature?
Certainly, and obviously our more conservative constituency are delighted with the turn of events. And some of the blue areas around Buncombe County, other folks aren't quite as happy.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for being on the program. John Elliston, a reporter for the Carolina Public Press. He joined us from WCQS in Asheville. Always a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Frank.
Laura Leslie, Capital Bureau Chief for WRAL. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
Just ahead, John Shane and Joe Newberry play live on The State of Things. Stay with us.